Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this meeting of the Kingborough Council on Monday, the 17th of May 2021. I'm Jo Westwood. I am the acting mayor for the next 6 or so weeks until our community elects a new mayor via a by-election. So I'd like to declare the meeting open and welcome everyone in attendance. Welcome to those people watching from home. You are welcome to come into the gallery if you like, if you register in advance, but certainly don't blame you at this time of year for watching at home. Council meetings are recorded and made publicly available on our website, and in accordance with Council's policy, I will request confirmation that the audio recording has commenced.
Confirmed.
Thank you, General Manager. I'd now like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land and pay respects to Elders past, present and emerging, and acknowledge today's Tasmanian Aboriginal community. Attendees tonight, we have myself, Acting Mayor Jo Westwood, we have Councillor Sue Bastone, Councillor Gideon Cordova, Councillor Flora Fox, Councillor Amanda Midgley, Councillor Christian Street, Councillor Steve Wass and Councillor Paula Reet. We have no apologies tonight. Can I have confirmation that the minutes of the open session of the Council meeting number 8 held on the 3rd of May 2021 be confirmed as a true record? Okay. Moved by Councillor Fox, seconded by Councillor Bastone. Our workshops held since our last Council meeting on the 10th of May, we held... Pardon? Oh, sorry. All those in favour that the minutes were true and correct?
Aye.
All those in favour say aye.
Aye.
All those against? Minutes are confirmed. Thank you. workshops held since the last council meeting. On the 10th of May, we held a workshop on the street tree policy. Declarations of interest. Does any councillor have a declaration of interest they'd like to draw to our attention tonight? Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Madam Acting Mayor. Recently I attended an event at Mary Knoll, but I have no pecuniary interest and will be participating in the discussions. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Does anyone else have anything they'd like to declare relating to tonight's agenda? Ah, Mr. Smee.
Acting Mayor, I wish to declare an interest in item 18.4, which relates to the naming of the Woodbridge Oval. I am a life member of the Woodbridge Cricket Club.
Thank you. Transfer of agenda items. Are there any items which a councillor believes should be transferred from open to closed session tonight? No. Code of Conduct Panel Determination Report. I did receive earlier today a medical certificate from Councillor David Grace. Not quite sure what this means in terms of the item before us tonight. General Manager, are you able to provide some advice, please?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, the implications, well, there may be none, depending. Councillor Grace has... now missed two consecutive meetings. The Local Government Act says that the office of a councillor becomes vacant if the councillor misses three consecutive meetings. The next scheduled meeting of council after tonight is the 7th of June, so one would expect that Councillor Grace will attend that meeting. If he is unable to attend, one would expect that Councillor Grace would put in a request for a leave of absence. The Chair mentioned that earlier today a medical certificate was received. That medical certificate did not accompany a request for a leave of absence or a request to the Chair to request a leave of absence.
Thank you, General Manager. Questions without notice from the public. Is there anyone in the gallery tonight who would like to ask some questions of Council without notice? No questions this week. Questions on notice from the public. At the time the agenda was compiled, there were no questions on notice from the public. For those watching at home, you are welcome to send in some questions if you have them, and we will address them as part of the meeting. Questions without notice from councillors. Councillor Bastone.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. The other day I was at the new playground and there was someone spraying poison while I was there, or I assume it was poison. He was gloved, he was wearing a mask, and he had a large tank on his back. This was amongst all the children. I'm just wondering if what sort of spray we're using and if this is going to be a regular occurrence. That's my first question.
Mr. Smee?
Through you, Acting Mayor, I would guess that that spraying work was being undertaken by the contractor, but I'd need to take on notice the details as to what the spray was and what the proposed spraying regime, if any, in the future would be.
Thank you. My next question is, which I think will have to be taken on notice. How many abatement notices for fire hazards or weed infestation have been issued in the last 12 months in Kingborough and with particular on Bruny Island?
We'll take that one on notice. Thanks,
thank you very
Councillor
much.
Bastone.
And my third and final one is, what obligation does the council have in regards to Sharps Road, which is in fact not a council road, but leads to properties that pay rates to the council and is in fact the only access to these properties?
Mr. Reeve?
Through you, Mayor, I'd have to look into that one in particular and provide a response back to you, but I would say that it is fairly common to have roads that are either private or vested in a body corporate or vested in a series of properties as well at the same time, so it's not that unusual for that to actually occur. Council may remember or may recall a report that was put up a little while ago about O'Brien's Road, very similar situation there where it had a number of properties there and a section of O'Brien's Road there which was vested with the property owners. So it's not an unusual situation. It does occur in lots of different municipalities. But for that particular case there, I'd be happy to take that on notice and provide a more fulsome response.
Thank you very much, Mr. Reeve.
Thanks, Councillor Bastone. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. My question is about the Appendix A Infrastructure Works Report, February to April. Is now a good time to ask those questions?
Yes, it is.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So my first question is about on page 156. I'd just like a bit more detail about Allen's Rivulet Road, the pine tree removal.
Mr. Reeve, are you able to answer that question, please?
Through you, Mayor, what was the actual question?
About why the pines were removed and how long it took and whether there's plans for plantings there.
Yeah, once again, I'd have to take that one on notice there and talk with our outside workforce about that one.
No worries, that's fine. And my next question is about item 21, Sandfly Hall. I would just like a bit more information about the repairs to the footings and the substructure. The new flooring looks fantastic and the epoxy coating, so well done all, but I just wanted more information about what was the issue with the substructure and the footings and how did all that come to pass?
Through you, Mayor. So a number of different halls have been identified as, I guess, being in the situation where they did need some additional work being done on it. We have been lucky enough to actually get some grant funding that's actually allowed us to do quite a bit of work on some of our halls this financial year. So that was an example of one of where it was identified through an inspection that some of the footings were substandard and needed replacement. The floor had already been earmarked for replacement as well at the same time, so we've sort of been able to value add to that project as well.
Thanks very much. And through you, Acting Mayor, another question just following up on that. With the grant funding, is there any possibility or are there plans in place to put solar panels on the Sandfly Community Hall? And is there an opportunity with grant funding to achieve that?
Mr. Reeve.
Through you, Mayor. I guess for next financial year, Council is looking at the option of potentially putting some solar panels on the sports centre, as you may be aware. We would also look at other buildings there on a case-by-case basis there, mainly based on what sort of return you would actually get for actually putting those solar panels on, so how much usage that building might have in terms of power there, and whether you get a system there that actually could counteract that with a reasonable payback as well at the same time. So in some cases it's actually worthwhile, in some cases it's not, but the intention would be to look at other buildings, not just the halls, but other buildings as well that might actually fit into that category going forward.
Thank you. My final question, Acting Mayor, is it true that there's usually about a return of every 7 years after the initial investment of solar panels? It takes about 7 years, I think, for the sports centre. Would that, can we infer that that would probably be the case for the other community halls as well, potentially?
Through you, Mayor, no, not necessarily. So it's horses for courses there. So it, once again, it really depends on the power usage for the building there. So the return to the grid isn't that great. In terms of actually returning the cost directly into the grid there. So what you really want to do is try and balance out the power usage of the building there, which depends very much on who's using it, when they're using it, as to say whether or not it's worthwhile actually putting a solar system on there to get a return. So yes, no, not necessarily.
Thank you.
Thanks, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I also have a question regarding the infrastructure report, and thank you very much for including this, and I encourage the public to read the great work that staff are doing, and thanks to all the staff for their great work. Question on page 161 regarding the Lunawana seating that were placed in behalf of a local residence, I think, encouragement and advocacy. I'm just wondering, what's our policy around putting seating like this picnic seating that is wheelchair friendly, like the great ones that we have in Kingston Park?
Mr. Reeve?
I guess that'd be assessed on a case-by-case basis there as to what we put in and where we put seating in the first instance there, but certainly we would like where we've got access to a seat, so in other words there's a path or whatever it happens to be leading up to it, to actually make sure that it is accessible by all users. So that's part of our, I guess, what we've signed off from council in terms of looking at universal design considerations there for anything we actually put in place there. So I think that's an important aspect of any infrastructure we put in, not just sets, if that's your question.
Thank you. I'm just looking at those seating. If I was at all needing some mobility, even if I wasn't in a wheelchair, just being able to get up and down on those seats, there's no armrests or anything like that either. So I guess I'm more wondering, how do we decide where we put in seating that perhaps is wheelchair friendly? Because you never know if a person on a bus might be going on a community visit and they might want to stop there and they might think that's a lovely place to stop. It'd be nice to be accessible for a wheelchair, and also for people who struggle to get up and down to have the armrests. I guess it's more, how do we decide whether to put seating like this or whether we put, I don't know the name for it, but seating that's accessible for people with mobility problems.
Mr. Reeve?
Yeah, look, what I can do is I can certainly have the discussion with our urban design coordinator about that side of things there and provide a bit more of a response back to you.
Okay, thank you very much. And my second question relates to actually a question that I asked last week, and I did follow up on that to make sure that I did get the right information from the community. So I asked a question in regards to if a bin had been removed from below Hole Road. So I've got to ask this in a question. So was there a bin that was directly below the blowhole sign? Was this bin relocated around the corner to the bottom end of the Mary Knoll Reserve? Because that's what the residents have told me, and they're seeing quite a lot of rubbish in regards to where the bin used to be.
Mr. Reeve?
Through you, Mayor. So my understanding is the bins are still in the place they were supposed to be, bearing in mind, not me personally, has been out there to have a look at it there, but we have got all our bins GPS located. But I guess the information that I provided onto staff there was only as good as what I actually had at the time there. So I'm happy to actually further chase that up now that we've mentioned it's directly underneath the blowhole sign. I would also take the opportunity to probably encourage anybody out there, councillors or anybody in the community there, if they do have any particular queries like this, the easiest thing to do is actually to ring up our customer service department and put through a service request, because then it gets action straight away and it gives an opportunity for the customer service staff to actually ask those very simple questions, exactly where it's located and so forth. So that would be something that I'd be encouraging all to do.
Great, thank you. I'll take that on notice.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from councillors without notice? No. In that case, we'll move to questions on notice from councillors. We have on page 3 a question from Councillor Midgley regarding the removal of a bin at Blowhole Road and an officer's response. We have a question regarding KWS from Councillor Wass with an officer's response on page 3. A question from Councillor Bastone regarding access to Connolly's Beach with a response on page 4. A question from Councillor Bastone regarding bins on Bruny Island with an officer's response. And a question from Councillor Bastone regarding bins at Kingston Beach with an officer's response on page 4. We now move to the Planning Authority. The open session adjourns and the Planning Authority commences at 5:45 p.m. So do I have someone to move the report DA 2020-480, development application for 30 multiple dwellings and sign at 15 Home Avenue, Blackmans Bay? Mover and a seconder? Thank you, Councillor Fox. And seconded by Councillor Street. Councillor Fox.
I wasn't expecting to be in this position, but I'm happy to be here. I recommend the report. I think most of the concerns that have been raised by the community have been addressed by the staff, and I guess there is only one concern that's been raised with me by the community, and that is whether there will be a guarantee that the vegetation which abuts the existing reserve will be maintained even when the fire rating has been determined. So that was a question from the community, but other than that, I feel that all the issues have been dealt with and the report is acceptable. Thank you.
Would you like some advice from Ms. Tyler Moore about the question?
Thank you. Yes.
Ms. Tyler Moore?
Through you, Deputy Mayor, the planning report details the trees that are to be removed. I won't read them all out because there's a number there, and then that's reiterated again in the planning permit conditions. If the application were to change in its design or layout, resulting in further trees having to be removed, they would have to actually come back for an amendment or a new planning permit to do so. So at this point, the vegetation removal is very limited. It's specified in the actual conditions as well as on the plans.
Thank you. And I understand there were some iterations of the plans and they haven't all been shown in each of the drawings. Is that correct through you, Acting Mayor?
Ms. Tyler Moore?
Through you, Acting Mayor, that's correct. So there's a lot of documents associated with this application, and as described in the background part of the report, the plans were amended during the process removing a number of those dwellings, and some of the reports lagged and still had some information that didn't match the plans, but certainly it's the plans that we based the report on, and that has been further clarified and tightened up through the permit conditions that we've applied to ensure that there's limited confusion.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I also do support this and thank the applicants and staff for working very closely together to ensure that we have a great outcome for all the community and the many people who will be residing there. I also had a question in regards to the inconsistencies with the plans, and I note that some members of the community putting in submissions did find that a bit confusing. One of them as well, in regards to the traffic impact, noting that one of the plans showed 38 dwellings to be constructed and then there was 43 dwellings. So I'm just wondering about that sort of change in numbers regarding the extra housing and the impact, how the impact on the traffic assessment will be applied.
Ms. Tyler Moore.
Through you, Mayor, the final assessment was based on 30 dwellings, so it is fewer than what the original assessment was. Again, that's one of those reports that had a lag in it and wasn't detailed, but certainly the details and considered impacts of that traffic around that network was considered by our development engineers, and they're comfortable with the outcomes and the design that's required. And as you'll see in the planning permit conditions, there are specifications about further design requirements that need to be submitted as part of the conditions.
Great, thank you.
Councillor Cordova.
Thanks very much, Acting Mayor. A couple of questions. Firstly, so am I right in thinking that the property numbers were reduced from 38 to 30? And can you just give us a sense of where those eight properties were removed from the plans and why, just to make it clear for everyone?
Ms. Tyler Moore.
Through you, Deputy Mayor, the yes, it's correct. It went from 38 to 30 dwellings. If you have a look at the plan, I'm actually not sure what page number it is in the report because I have a separate set. The overall one that has the green area, I just zoom.
So there's one on page 35 and then there's...
Yeah, so page 36,
yep.
You can see that. So the houses that were removed occurred to the rear of those properties that you see on the left-hand side. Because of the reason was because it had conflict with some of the bushfire requirements, and so they removed them from the plans, the complicated ones, out of the design. I couldn't say 100% that they were all the dwellings that were removed. I would have to look at the detail for that, but that's my general understanding.
Thank you. And my next question is about the high conservation value tree. So I'm right in assuming, but you can take us through this if you please, that there are now no longer high conservation value trees that are planned for removal except the one. And can you take us through where that one is and how that will be retained and hopefully allay our fears that that will actually be enforced and will be that tree will be offset?
Ms. Tyler Moore.
Through you, Deputy Mayor, I'm just scrolling up to the relevant part. So as you'll see, it's fairly detailed, the report with respect to the trees, and there's a description about the various trees, including a table at the start. Sorry, I'm just scrolling towards it. So on page 12 of the report, all the trees are listed in there, and trees identified for attention, which may have been impacted by the unit development, are listed there. And the one significant tree, just bear with me.
There is a mention of that one high conservation value tree at point C of page 23 of our report that refers to the Part 5 agreement, and it says in Part C, under tree protection, the one tree of high conservation value proposed for removal will be offset to the satisfaction of council through inclusion of a condition on any permit issued to this effect. So I'm just interested to know where and what that tree is and...
Try to find the plan that depicts the tree. So part of the advertising documents was the natural values assessment, which contain it.
Are there any other contributions while Ms. Tyler Moore's having a look? It's fine, we're putting you under pressure.
Sorry, very large documents to scroll through, I'm afraid.
I'm just
trying to find the plan because there is a plan in, with the natural values and an arborist report as well. And unfortunately, off the top of my head, I don't know the location of the tree, and the officer's not here.
But you were able to confirm, though, that the line of trees, the line of gums, that I think there were blue gums and a white gum. This relates to Councillor Fox's question, that those will be retained even if the bell assessment changes. So they're going to keep a lot of the trees.
Through you, Deputy Mayor, the trees within the reservation are to be retained.
Yep.
The tree that's referred to be removed is in subject site because only the subject site's included in the application. The neighbouring reservation isn't included. And I believe that the tree in question, and I'm probably just need to double check this, sort of occurs in the northern half centrally on the site. I think it wasn't far from one of the existing buildings.
Okay. My next question then, if that's all the detail we get on that.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. My next question is about what's being done to minimise bird strike and other protections to avoid negatively impacting the swift parrot. And I'm aware that there's some reference to glazing and no fly-throughs and things like that. But my question is really, no corner windows as well. So that's explained on page 23 and 24 of our report as well. I've got a particular interest in firstly, if you could take us through what are those provisions to protect any damage to the critically endangered swift parrot, and also how is that enforced?
Ms. Tyler Moore.
Through you, Mayor, they're protected obviously through the retention of the vegetation that's in that area and limiting and trying to minimise as much vegetation to be removed. The bird strike condition is something that many councils use and have the provisions in there, and that's to do with the window treatments, whether it's the type of glazing or the tilt of the glass and so forth, and no sight lines through that. It's enforced by the fact that it's on the plans and is enforceable. And quite often we have a condition that says that it must be reflected in the building plans. In saying that, there's been new changes to the Building Act 2016 brought in by the state government, which does change some of the requirements with respect to what a building surveyor has to check or doesn't have to check. But regardless, even if it doesn't appear on the building permit, it was still enforceable under the planning permit, and we would undertake inspections to check that.
Thanks. And is there any provision that the council has beyond the planning scheme to enforce that? Like, do we have any kind of relevant bylaw or any relevant biodiversity protection policy that would allow us to double check?
Ms. Tyler Moore.
Through you, Deputy Mayor, not outside the planning scheme, I'm not aware of any bylaws or provisions that control buildings and works.
Thanks. My next question is about the Part 5 agreement, and so I'm looking now at page 24, the top of page 24. In terms of cat control, can you take us through the requirement? It says here the requirements for cat control are on the title and binding on future owners. Can you take us through what those cat control measures are?
Ms. Tyler Moore.
Through you, Mayor, I'm just scrolling, was page 24, the Part 5?
So it's the it's 2.52, Part 5 Agreement is the title of the subsection, and then the issues that it deals with are tree protection, swift parrot, amenity of 2 and 2A Ocean Esplanade, visual impact, and then cat control.
Thank you. Through you, Deputy Mayor, the cat control, I believe, was brought in as part of the subdivision application, not this application. It was brought in during the hearing, from my recollection, and it is actually a little unusual to have it put on a subdivision application. So it was in there. We would have to look at the wording in the Part 5 agreement, which I have access to and I can look up, but it'll just take me a bit of time to get into that file. About what they are. Typically it's to do with the cats must be, that cats have a curfew, but I don't think it goes insofar as saying that you can't have cats outside at all, but I can stand corrected on that and look at the detail, but it's already included in the subdivision permit.
Okay, thanks. Just a couple more questions, and I'm sorry to be dragging this out. I guess the crux of what I'm trying to get to is that there's been a number of representations which I think raise fairly... fair concerns. Some of them are answered really well within the report, but essentially they are that the environmental impacts of the proposal and the retention of high conservation value trees, and of course making sure that we don't destroy the last remnant habitat for swift parrots. My next question is, do we have confidence in the traffic impact assessments? And I think Councillor Midgley alluded to this before, in some of the representations there was talk about inconsistencies in the traffic impact assessments. Can you take us through?
Ms Tyler Moore.
If that's relevant.
Through you, Deputy Mayor, our development engineers reviewed the application at all stages. So at the first stage when the application came in with the full suite of units in it, and then and included their concerns in the request for further information, which was quite lengthy to the applicant. And then once the information came back, and then the final change plans were reviewed again by the development engineers, and part of their report is in the attachment at the end of this report. But they were comfortable with the volume and number of vehicle movements that will occur from the site, so there were no particular concerns raised. Naturally, residents of the area will have concern, and yes, there will be an increase of traffic in that area, but it's within an established urban area and the road network is capable of accommodating that additional load.
Thank you. Can you please talk to us about public open space? I read here that the subdivision application sought to create originally 22 residential lots, 3 public open space lots and 2 road lots. I noticed that some of the actual proposed units here don't have compliant open space. Can you take us through what makes it acceptable in your opinion?
Ms Tyler Moore.
Through you, Deputy Mayor, public open space and private open space are different beasts. Public open space is what people would consider as like a park or a parklet, might include walkways and that. So that was dealt with under the subdivision because it's a requirement under the subdivision provisions that public open space be provided, and if it's not, cash in lieu payments, which the councillors would all be familiar with. Private open space that you refer to is the backyards in lay terms, and there were a number, as listed in the report, that didn't comply, and that was to do with orientation and size and direct access from those living areas. It's worth noting, so they were justified in the report why it was believed that it was acceptable, it met the performance criteria, but it is just worth noting under the new provisions that the state government's brought in under IPD 4 and now PD 8, which is on public consultation, it has removed that requirement to have direct access from living areas. Not that it influences this application because this was lodged before those changes to the planning scheme came in, but it's... just worthwhile to have that in mind.
Thank you. And so to clarify, yeah, there are a number of dwellings in this proposal that don't have an area of private open space that complies with all the requirements in A2, but the conditions... So what conditions are listed that... is it simply that there's public open space nearby, which means that they're fine, or it's just a completely different thing?
Ms Tyler Moore.
Through you, Deputy Mayor. So if it doesn't meet the acceptable solution, which those ones don't, it then defaults to having to assess it against the performance criteria. The officer assessing the application found that it did meet the performance criteria, and the justification for that is included in the report. The planning scheme strangely doesn't really talk about is there public open space available in the area, but certainly from a basic planning assessment, we consider that, but it can't form part of the performance criteria. So those public open space requirements aren't required for multi-dwellings. The planning scheme doesn't trigger the need for us to consider provision of public open space or public open space in lieu of private open space.
Okay, thank you. So through you, Acting Mayor, I maintain my concerns and reservations over this. It's a very nuanced and comprehensive report, and it's very comprehensive, so it was quite difficult for me to delve into it, but actually I think a lot of it is there, and it allays some of my concerns. The final amended plans indicate no high conservation value trees require removal for the proposed unit development except for that one, which is then offset, and impacts are limited to encroachment into the tree protection zone. And it goes on to say that the way that they've achieved this is by reducing the number of overall units on that proposal down from 38 to 30. It also talks about how the provisions of the planning scheme, including the zones and code overlays, derive from state policies and the approval of the scheme by the planning minister on the basis that it is compliant with those policies. On that basis, a separate assessment against those policies is not required. This proposal is consistent with the outcomes of the state policies, including those of the coastal policy, and it goes on essentially saying that to each of the significant and reasonable concerns that have been raised by the representatives on this occasion, they have been sufficiently mitigated by the performance criteria, and so to that extent, I really have to rely on the expertise of our planning staff, and so on this occasion, I will be accepting the proposal. Thanks.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I just wanted to make a brief comment on this matter to thank staff for the comprehensive way in which they've put together the report. I know that it wouldn't have been an easy one to assess given the number of dwellings in one application. It would have been an extensive process. So thank you for that, and thank you for the comprehensive way in which you've produced the advice. I'm satisfied that the application does meet the requirements of the planning scheme, and I will be voting in favour of it. The one thing that I did want to just touch on is and really only because Councillor Cordova touched on it himself, was the retention of high conservation value trees, just because I wanted to ensure that my reading of the report was correct. And that is that there's not actually any high conservation value trees affected. Sorry, there won't be any removal of high conservation value trees as a result of this particular DA, in accordance with the comments at the bottom of page 13 of the report. I thought that the high conservation value tree that was mentioned in the Part 5 was as a result of the original subdivision DA, which would have already been dealt with as part of the subdivision DA, so an issue quite separate to the application in front of us, but I could be wrong about that. I just wanted to make sure that what I was thinking was at least close to the mark.
Through you, Deputy Mayor, on page 12, that I've found it, the comments are there that, none of the trees propose removal of high conservation value and the remaining trees proposed for retention. The proposed unit development encroaches in the tree protection zones of 8 high conservation trees. So it's not the trees not coming out, it's within the tree protection zones of those. So if there is a tree to come out, which I believe there was in the subdivision application, then it's in that subdivision.
And it was dealt with back then.
And dealt with.
Yes, yeah. Excellent. Okay. Thank you, Acting Mayor.
Thank you. Councillor Fox, would you like to sum up?
No, thank you, everybody, for the detailed reading of the report. There are many questions, and I'm pleased they've all been answered. Thank you.
So the recommendation before us is that the Planning Authority resolves that the development application for 30 multiple dwellings and sign at Presentation Sisters, 15 Home Avenue, Blackmans Bay, for JMG Engineers be approved, subject to 16 conditions. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Those against? Motion is carried. Planning Authority session now adjourns and the open session commences at 6:08. We now move on to motions of which notice has been given. On page 65, we have a notice of motion from Councillor Woss regarding costs associated with Code of Conduct panel determination. Councillor Woss.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I would like to move the following motion. The Council put...
Thank you, Councillor Reid.
Okay, I'll read it out and then I'll start. The Council put the following motion to the next general meeting of the Local Government Association of Tasmania, hereinafter referred to as LGAT, that LGAT lobbied the state government to change S28ZNA2 of the Local Government Act 1993 to require that if, as a result of a determination report, a councillor is required to undergo training, the costs associated with that training are to be borne by the relevant councillor, not the ratepayer. This council some 3-4 months ago also took back to the Minister for Local Government what we consider to be an error in the Code of Conduct process, and I think here is another one. To give you an example, if you go and buy yourself a Honda and you're coming down the highway and you're exceeding the speed limit, or you don't have headlights or you don't have taillights or whatever it might be, and you get pulled over, Honda don't pay your fine, even though it's a Honda motor vehicle. And certainly the Honda dealer is not going to be fined because of it. You, the owner, will be fined. If you're driving a company car and again you infringe, the company is required under legislation to, if you want, to advise who the driver of that vehicle was, and that driver, he or she, will then face a fine for breaking that road law. In this case, the determination has been made on a case that involves two councillors in our council, and training is a requirement, or that councillor will have to undertake training. And the question came up some week ago, at some last meeting, as to who would pay for the training. And under the Code of Conduct, it is then paid by the ratepayers or the local council. That, to me, is not right. It's right only if the person who is guilty of an offence pays that particular fine. Otherwise, there is no deterrent to any councillor to do the right thing. It could happen to a council anywhere throughout the state. There could be 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 councillors up on a code of conduct. And if the requirement was the same as in this case, then council, that particular council, and let's hope it never occurs, but that council would be required to pick up the tab for all that training that was undertaken in anger management, as this one is. This is not about the councillor or councillors involved. This is really about a flaw or an error in the system, and we need to bring this to LGAT's attention so that collectively all councils can vote on it and take it to the Minister for Local Government, because it does need changing. There's an old saying in Australia that if you do the crime, you do the time. This one unfortunately means that you don't do the time, and as I indicated before, there is no determinant to stop the said councillor or future councillors doing likewise. And although it won't have a financial impact on any councillors in relation to this particular incident, it is really unfair that the ratepayers get to pay and account for something that they had no say and were not even aware occurred. So I do recommend, councillors, that you consider this very seriously, because it's a flaw that we need to change. and I ask you to support the motion. Thank you, Acting Mayor.
Thank you, Councillor Woss. Councillor Reid.
Thank you. I'm pleased to support this motion because I was not aware that the situation existed when I put forward my code of conduct complaint, that council could be left footing the bill for the determination that was handed down. I think that is greatly unfair, and once again it is also greatly unfair that the said councillor is not here this evening, because it is dragging on and dragging on. There are other states in Australia where there are provisions in their local government act under their code of conduct for their panels to actually not only have the raft of possible things for to penalties to be put in place for the for councillors who have had a finding against them, but they, in addition, South Australia, for example, have one which says that the panel can request the member to repay monies to the council. And there's no definition within their provisions under their South Australian Code of Conduct as to what that actually means. They haven't defined it just in terms of training, so it could also mean the costs of the hearings, I assume. So I do hope that the state government takes this very seriously, because it is not fair at all that this council and our ratepayers have to pay for something that was absolutely inappropriate and put this council in a bad light as well collectively, even though there was only one other person who was breaching the code of conduct. So I hope the state government looks at it. I think that my experience with the code of conduct altogether, I think there are a range of things that I would like to hope that the government would consider, and I look forward to us having a new ministry announced and a new minister for local government, because I have now, having gone through that process from start to finish, as a number of witnesses did, I know that we have a range of suggestions as to how it could operate more effectively for not only the individuals involved but for the councils involved as well. So I do take this matter very seriously, and I do hope that when this goes before a local government association meeting, that we have the support of other councils, because I suspect there have been many of them who have been stung by this, and it's not a way we want to leave it for the future.
Thank you, Councillor Reid. Councillor Fox.
I can understand the reason for the motion, and I can understand the passion that councillors feel on this issue, but we are dealing with an existing process, and I am concerned that the value of the training of the individual is something that the whole council would benefit by. In fact, the whole industry would benefit by that training. And I know that in this case, I understand we all agree that there has been a wrong done, and that wrong was upheld by the tribunal in this case. But in terms of the process, the whole process needs to be looked at, and to be isolating this particular incident and referring to that specifically in terms of who pays for the training, I feel is something that will be part of the review process. And I don't support that I don't support the motion, basically, because I feel any training of any councillor, even if it's a penalty, is going to be good for the whole community, it's going to be good for the council, and it's going to be good for the industry in general. And I don't see why that person individually has to pay for that. In this case, it might well be affordable. In other cases, it might not be affordable for the individual. So I think it might border on discrimination. But for those reasons, I don't support the motion. I hope councillors understand.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. Firstly, in my remarks on this item, I'm speaking about the motion before us and how it relates to all future Code of Conduct panel determinations. This matter before us seeks to involve this council not just in, or seeks to involve this council not just in making recommendations about the individual case that we saw between two councillors at Kingborough, but it speaks more widely to all future Code of Conduct cases. And so, to be clear, in these remarks, I'm deliberately referring to the entire Code of Conduct process, and I'm deliberately not referring to the specific circumstances of the determination of the recent case concerning Councillor Grace and Councillor Reid. That's a matter that has been determined, and I made very extensive comments about that at the last council meeting. So, basically, I think that to date, this council has sufficiently engaged with the process, and we've sufficiently involved ourselves in that determination process. For example, this council has written on previous occasions expressing our utter lack of confidence in the panel process. Individual councillors, myself included, have spoken at length about their concerns that the panel process does not sufficiently protect victims or witnesses. Councillors have also opined that the Code of Conduct seems sometimes to prosecute for things that don't really matter, such as making determinations over the provision of breath mints. But then at other times, when things really do matter, like issues of threats and intimidation, then the code seems to have a limp lettuce, slap on the wrist approach, which may not sufficiently curb bad behaviour or act as a deterrent, as Councillor Wass rightly pointed out. We've said what we needed to say, both as individuals and as a council, and so I don't believe that on this occasion it's warranted to delve even further and start making specific suggestions about sentencing or meting out justice or specific changes that the code should make. If we want to do that as a council, then we should do it methodically and be strategic about it and not just make ad hoc recommendations. As Councillor Reid pointed out, there are numerous problems with this process, and we need to address it holistically and not just niggle around the edges, but actually, you know, if we wanted to, we could sit down with LEGAT, sit down as a cohort, go through the full process and make informed recommendations about a whole gamut of issues. Otherwise, we might end up having to make several, you know, send several dozen letters individually about several individual dozen recommendations on how to make the Code of Conduct panel process fit for purpose, to make it fairer, more transparent, less arduous, with the hope of making its outcomes more just. However, to embark on that process, I would suggest, is heading down a route which is not a particularly prudent use of the Council's time and resources. So first and foremost, I think we need to avoid interfering in an independent process. If LEGAT wants to change the rules about Code of Conducts, then they should run a consultative process, be transparent about the changes that they're considering, and then they should seek our feedback along with all of the other local government authorities. That's the best way forward. Recommending ad hoc changes, piece by piece, council by council, is not the best way forward, and if implemented, I fear that it might lead to unforeseen or inequitable outcomes. For example, if this change were implemented, then it's unidirectional. And what I mean by that is it says that if a determination is made against a councillor that requires training, then the costs should fall on that councillor. But what if a determination were to go the other way? There's nothing in this letter that asks the litigant, for example, to pay for the costs of the process if the matter is found to exonerate the councillor. The letter does not speak to the well-being of witnesses in giving evidence, which I think we all agree is something that urgently needs fixing. And the letter is very specific, but because it's very specific, it will not go any way to fixing what is fundamentally broken about this Code of Conduct process. So if this change were to be implemented, in my mind's eye, would we vehemently defend the Code of Conduct process after they implement this one small change? Would we throw up our hands and say, OK, it's all fixed, it's all perfect, we now have confidence in the system? I certainly wouldn't. This letter is fiddling at the edges but not speaking to the real issues. If this change were implemented, what would stop a councillor choosing which training course they do? I can anticipate that any councillor who's... They just pick the cheapest YouTube short course, and it might not actually give the training what the determination actually wanted. We must remember that training is designed to train the person. It is not the punishment. The punishment is the punishment. So a rebuke, a sanction, a suspension or a fine, that's a punishment. Training is development. Imposing a financial cost is a penalty. Now, I'm not shy about the idea of the Code of Conduct panel imposing financial penalties. That's a decision for them to make. But let's be clear about it. Financial penalty is the financial penalty. It isn't a penalty disguised as training. the panel imposes training as a means of rehabilitating and developing a person who is found to require that training. So let us not resort to sophistry to sneak in financial penalties in the guise of technical training costs. If we want councillors to pay fines, I think that's fine and probably a worthy thing. If they're found against in a code of conduct... Can I please have 3 more minutes? I'm very, very near the end.
Do we have someone to move for Councillor Cordova to have 3 more minutes? Thank you, Councillor Bastone, seconded by Councillor Midgley.
Thank you.
Please, go ahead.
Do we need to vote on
that? Oh, no, sorry. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against?
Thank you
go
so
ahead,
much.
Thanks, Acting Mayor.
Thank you for your indulgence. Look, I just want, if we did send a letter, I would want it to make a sweeping set of recommendations. I wouldn't just want it to deal with this one issue. And I also am concerned about, deliberately interfering time and time again into the independence of a process. I think that tends to undermine people's trust in that institution, and I would welcome an urgent review of the code of conduct process, and I would welcome our council to get involved, really stuck in and get involved to engage with that process of a review and give a feedback on a whole range of issues. But at the end of the day, I am in agreement with all my colleagues around this table about the code of conduct not being fit for purpose and about it being in need of serious and urgent review. And as I said last meeting, I stand in complete support of Councillor Reid and her right to come to work in a safe workplace, as I stand by that right for all Australians, for everyone. Any review of the code of conduct process should be comprehensive and not piecemeal. It should be methodical and not ad hoc. Any review of the process should be fair and unaligned and not compromise political independence. The point is that we need to have confidence that our elected representatives can be held account in a way that is fair and proportionate to deliver just outcomes and ensure the integrity of local government. Our council needs to strive to ensure that our own workplace is safe and our process is robust. How the panel makes their determinations and what financial penalties they hand down, I believe, is a matter for them. But here at Kingborough, I think we now need to focus on the business of the council and let panel decisions be guided by their own consideration. Thanks.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. Mine will be brief. I do support this motion. I believe I take on what Councillor Cordova and Councillor Fox have raised. I kind of see this as a bit of like changing the speed limit. We write letters, they say no, they sometimes take things into account. I see this as a bit of a bigger picture thing. We're setting up a line of catalysts that will actually implement a change. Yes, they might not write back and make this change straight away, but I hope with not only our letter and with the things that we're putting forward at our council, but many other councils that are calling on for review of the Code of Conduct panel, I do hope that with the new government, they will come back, they will ask questions. It won't be probably a thing that will happen overnight, but I think we're setting catalysts and conversations in place to say this needs an urgent review, and that's why I'm supporting this motion.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. For my contribution, I also support the motion. We have spent nearly 20 minutes talking about this tonight, and I think it is important to talk about this. I, along with other colleagues on council, was very surprised to find out that a sanction of training, anger management training no less, that had been handed down would be essentially paid for by the residents of Kingborough. I don't think that's appropriate. I think we can all agree that it's not appropriate, and I don't see the harm in putting forward a notice of motion that asks LGAT to advocate to the state government to tell them that we don't think it's appropriate. Councillor Woss, would you like to sum up?
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I'll just touch on a couple of items that were raised, and one was training. Training is not the issue here, and I've always supported training for all facets, not just because of a code of conduct, but I think all councillors should undertake training on a very regular basis, year in, year out, so that all councillors remain abreast of what's happening around the world. Whereas what we find generally with training is that you might go to one and you could stay on council for 20 years and never go to another one. That, to me, doesn't rhyme. But that, again, is nothing to do with a motion, but I wanted to touch on training because it had been mentioned. There is no meddling with the panel decision, the process or the determination. This is clearly a flaw that has been seen, and I believe that flaw needs to be corrected. if you're guilty of a crime and there is a sanction made, we suggest, or I'm suggesting, that that sanction should be supported. But if there's a financial determination in that, then the councillor concerned, or councillors concerned, if there's more than one, should pay the price of that requirement, they undertake training or what it might be, not members of the public or our ratepayers. The code of conduct needs to be able to address inappropriate behaviour. If it doesn't, if it cannot address inappropriate behaviour, it will simply be seen as a badge of honour. A badge of honour so that the meeting can be disrupted, everything can be out of control, there's no determination, and if you take me to the code of conduct, it's going to cost you money, it's going to cost the council money, and whatever the penalty is at the end of the line, I won't be paying either. So where is the inappropriate or the appropriate measure there? There's none, and we need to bring it to other councils so that together, collectively, we can take it from Legat to the minister to say, look, here is a flaw, we need that to be resolved. And on that basis, that's what the motion is endeavouring to do. It is not being involved, there is no meddling with a determination, a decision, a process. It is clearly looking at the result financially from our ratepayers' base and obviously from a person who creates inappropriate behaviour to pay for his or her misdemeanours. I would ask that you support this motion.
Thank you, Councillor Woss. The motion we have before us is that LGAT, the Local Government Association of Tasmania, lobby the State Government to change Section 28ZNA2 of the Local Government Act 1993 to require that if, as a result of a determination report, a councillor is required to undergo training, the costs associated with that training are to be borne by the relevant councillor and not the ratepayer. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Those against? We have a division. All those in favour, please raise your hand. We have Councillor Street, Bastone, Reet, Midgley, Woss and Westwood. And those against, we have Councillors Fox and Cordova. The motion is carried. We now move on to petitions still being actioned on page 65. There are no petitions still being actioned. Petitions were received in the last period. At the time this agenda was compiled, no petitions had been received. And that takes us to the officers' reports to council, the first one being fees and charges 2021-22. Do I have someone to move the recommendation that council adopts the attached fees and charges schedule for the 2021-22 financial year? Moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Bastone. Thank you, Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. So we're looking at the fees and charges for 21-22 financial year. Essentially, in general, the fees and charges have been increased by 3% in line with the long-term financial plan, unless a higher fee is warranted to cover the cost of providing the service or to align with other councils. Essentially, they've been updated to cover the 2021-22 year. So I welcome discussion.
Thank you. Councillor Reet.
Thank you. I've just got a question on the first page of the fees and charges. Item number 6, it indicates that it's a new charge. Discretionary residential minor structure or fencing only. I assume that those were previously covered under different fees and these are lower to reflect the smaller nature of those developments, or could we have an explanation?
Through you,
Deputy Mayor.
Yes, you're correct,
Councillor
Reet.
Okay, thank you.
Councillor Bastone.
Sorry, I have a few questions. One is also on this side one. On number 6, as Councillor Reet has just asked, Do we now have to have a permit to put up a fence between two properties, even if both parties agree?
So this relates to discretionary matters. So if it's permitted, obviously. So it depends on where they are in the planning scheme, what the overlays are, what zones they're in and so forth. So it doesn't specify at that level for the fees. So boundary fences are different than perhaps, front fences, commercial fences, those sorts of things. So it's where it's discretionary.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, I'm going to be really going through this. On number 58, the building fees, building survey fee, which is new, and all the other building survey fees have been taken out. It's a building survey consultant fee plus 30% council administration fee with GST. Do we have any indication at all about what sort of pricing this is? Noting in the old surveying fees, it was as high as $1,250.
I can't provide that. I'd have to take that on notice because it's very market-driven, so I'd need to look at what the market factors have been of late. The reason for all the changes to the building permit fees, though, relates to the changes in the building legislation. So we've had to reconfigure to capture the different types of work that have come as a consequence of that, and some things which are now permitted but still have a resourcing impact for council. So.
Okay. These are lovely big sheets of paper, but some of these ones, number 100, application for notifiable plumbing work, has gone up 56%. And it's a change to description of service, increase in fee to cover costs of providing the service. I really don't understand what these extra costs are on and above what we normally used to do. There's quite a number like that where it's gone up, 127%. I know the majority have only gone up 3%, but some of them are quite large.
So some of it are about changed requirements, which have a greater resourcing effort required of the staff, but also the costs of attracting staff to certain skilled positions has gone up, so our costs are greater as well. So it's the double whammy of the change requirements plus the context that we're working in where it's very competitive for some of these skill sets.
Okay, now I was trying to work out the sorts of costs that are now going to be borne by people who want to build a new house in our municipality, but because things like the building surveyor consultant fees and things, you can't work it out. But would it be right to say the fees would be in excess of about $3,500 to build a house?
I'd have to look into that because it's value related, of course, our fees. So I'll take that on notice.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so the recommendation before... Oh, sorry, Councillor Cordova, would you like to sum up?
Thank you.
The recommendation is that Council adopt the attached fees and charges schedule for the 2021-22 financial year, moved by Councillor Cordova and seconded by Councillor Bastone. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against? The motion is carried unanimously. We now move to page 90, a proposed amendment to the urban growth boundary of the Southern Tasmania Regional Land Use Strategy, 69 Brighton Road, Brighton. Do I have a mover? Councillor Fox, thank you. Seconded by Councillor Street. Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Madam Acting Mayor. I understand that this is an adjustment which is required by the Brighton Council in order to rezone an area of land that was actually zoned rural resource, but the government requires it for an education department facility. So there's a request from the council that the area be allowed to become a high school, and I support the motion. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Councillor Cordova.
A quick question, potentially for, well, for whoever would care to answer it. I note that Hobart City Council, on their last meeting, my understanding is they might have voted against it. The motion might have been lost. Is there any commentary around that that the General Manager might like to provide or something, or whoever?
Dr. Stevenson.
Through you, Acting Mayor. My understanding of the reason that Hobart didn't support it was a philosophical objection to continual adjustments of the urban growth boundary, even minor ones, as opposed to advocating for a strategic wholesale review of the regional land use strategy. But I would note that we have seen similar minor amendments come forward, and ultimately the Tasmanian Planning Commission has to weigh the various factors in relation to these requests.
Thank you very much for that. If I might go on to my substantive, I think that whilst I note the Hobart City Council's decision, and of course in the I fully understand and appreciate the philosophical objection to a piecemeal ad hoc approach to things, as anybody who's listened to this entire council meeting will appreciate. On this occasion, I looked at the map around the area, and I read the report, and it seems like it's a pretty good idea to me. So it's interesting that, what's that expression about not letting the good get in the way of the perfect, or vice versa? So on this occasion, I will be supporting this, but I'll take the opportunity to say that I think that we really need to look at the urban growth boundary and the Southern Tasmanian Regional Land Use Strategy, because it's like way out of date. But I will be supporting this. Thanks.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I just want to add my voice to the matter before us, because it does, as Councillor Cordova's pointed out, raise the issue of the Strelas and the fact that it is dreadfully out of date. If Brighton want to put an amendment forward to the Tasmanian Planning Commission, then I don't think this council or any other council has any place in standing in the way of that. And I will note that Hobart City Council only found their philosophical objections to this after everybody else passed their amendment that they requested recently. So I find that quite incredible as well. But I will be supporting the motion.
Thank you, Councillor Street. Councillor Fox, would you like to sum up?
I think obviously there's a strong message that the government should be listening to, is that we're all concerned about the lack of strategic planning from the statewide perspective, and all councils are basically copying that, and it's worth noting and maybe passing that message on formally to the state government that we support this motion, but we're not happy about the lack of strategic planning. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. So the recommendation before us tonight is that Council notes the proposal being considered by the City of Brighton Council and indicates in principle support for amendment to the urban growth boundary contained in the Southern Tasmanian Regional Strategy, moved by Councillor Fox and seconded by Councillor Street. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Those against? Motion is carried unanimously. We now move to page 93 of our agenda, which deals with the policy on the establishment of bushfire hazard management areas on council land. The recommendation being that council approve the updated establishment of bushfire hazard management areas on council land policy 4.13. Do I have a mover for this, please? Councillor Fox, seconded by Councillor Cordova. Thank you. Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I feel that this is a very important decision that we're making tonight. I think there is a lot of bush surrounding residential land, and quite often the council reserves are under pressure to be modified and adapted to allow for a building to be built in an otherwise threatened environment. And I think it's good that we have a consistent approach to this issue and that we have guidelines and processes for the residents and for council to consider, and to have an opportunity to say yes, but also an opportunity to say no as a council. And I think it's better for to be managing the situation proactively in this way than to be forever responding to requests and not having any guidelines. So I recommend the motion. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Councillor Cordova.
Thanks, Acting Mayor. Just to add to Councillor Fox's comments there, we're experiencing an enormous amount of growth in the Kingborough municipality, which is good in some respects, and it comes with issues in other respects. And so particularly for environmental conservation, there's effects there, and also for amenity and lifestyle, there's effects there, and public transport, there's effects. And here, when it comes to bushfire-prone areas, as more development occurs, it is foreseeable that council will receive an increasing number of requests to establish and maintain hazard management areas on council-owned or managed land for the benefit of private developments. And so I think what's really important about this contribution, and we all enjoyed the workshop, it was a very informative workshop about this, is that there is considerable cost associated with clearing vegetation for the establishment and ongoing maintenance of hazard management areas, and this policy seeks to mitigate that, essentially. And so I just wanted to point out that this is an issue that the council has its eyes on, because in every respect, as development takes place, we need to have these kind of long-term views about managing for that development, and this is just one of those examples. So because so much of the Kingborough municipality is bushfire prone, it really is one of our chief risks to manage, one of our primary risks to manage, and so, I just would like to reiterate the importance of it and why this is being proposed tonight, so I support it. Thanks.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Fox, would you like to sum up? We have before us a recommendation that Council approve the updated establishment of bushfire hazard management areas on Council land, policy 4.13. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against? Motion is carried unanimously. We now move to page 110. Which is regarding the Woodbridge Recreation Ground Sports Pavilion commemorative naming proposal. Do I have a mover, Councillor Bastone, seconded by Councillor Midgley? Councillor Bastone.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. The purpose of this report is to present the results of the engagement activity undertaken by the Council in relation to a proposal by the Woodbridge Cricket Club to name the Woodbridge Recreational Ground, also known as the Woodbridge Oval, after Miss Lily Poulett-Harris, and to consider a revised recommendation to commemorate Lily Poulett-Harris by naming the sports pavilion at the Woodbridge Recreation Ground in her honour. This has been quite a contentious issue within the Woodbridge community, and I note in the voting and the surveys 49 people who did not live in Woodbridge also managed to reply to the survey and, should I say, put their oar into it as well. So it's been contentious. The longer-term residents of Woodbridge have always known it just as the Oval or the Rec, and were unhappy about having the ground named after someone who never played at the ground. But as we have looked, Lily Poulett-Harris played cricket and was an instigator of women's cricket within Tasmania, but she in fact lived in Woodbridge and played cricket in an area which is now just normal housing area at Oyster Cove. So I think it's quite a good compromise. It doesn't do what they were hoping it would do, which was to have the name Lily Poulett-Harris on the oval, which would then show up on maps. But it does honour her and her contribution to women's sport, which I think is something that we'd all be very keen about. and for it to be in time for the 175th anniversary of the founding of Woodbridge as Woodbridge, I think is a wonderful thing. So I commend the Council's conclusion, which is that the Council endorse a proposal submitted by the Woodbridge Cricket Club to name the sports pavilion at Woodbridge Recreational Ground in honour of Lily Poulett Harris, with approved commemorative wording being Lily Poulett Harris Pavilion. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Bastone. Councillor Wath.
Yes, thank you, Acting Mayor. It's true that Lily Poulett Harris did not play cricket at Woodbridge, nor was her father or brother involved. And Lily played at the Oyster Cove Ladies Cricket Club and was unanimously elected as the captain, of which she had for 2 years. She lived in Woodbridge for 8 years approximately and had other claims to fame as well, which I won't go into, but I do believe that this is a good compromise. Certainly the community was split on this particular item, and it does give the opportunity for the Woodbridge Cricket Club to use Lily Poulett Harris in the sports pavilion, and that's what they intend to do, which to many local residents, the wreck is still the wreck, as it has been called since it was established. It doesn't change that, and it certainly does acknowledge Lily's contribution to sport and also her other contribution in church and education within the Woodbridge area. So I do support the recommendation.
Thank you, Councillor Wass. Did you have a question, Councillor Bastone?
Oh, sorry.
Nope. Would you like to sum up, Councillor Bastone?
Stop.
Thank you. We have before us a recommendation that Council endorse a proposal submitted by the Woodbridge Cricket Club to name the sports pavilion at Woodbridge Recreation Ground in honour of Lily Poulett Harris, with the approved commemorative wording being Lily Poulett Harris Pavilion. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against? Motion is carried unanimously. We now move to page 114 of our agenda paper, which is regarding Taroona Park, proposal to fund and install additional seating. Moved by Councillor Reid, seconded by Councillor Midgley. Councillor Reid.
Thank you. This is very exciting for the residents of the area, and particularly those residents in Taroona who do make use of the park. It's a very, that whole area is very well used, and it covers quite a distance, so it is important that we have resting places appropriately placed within the park, because I think it's part of that sort of connecting communities together, and the ability of people to go to a park and sit down and chat is, I think, a really significant part. We often think of parks as just a passive place, but I think they can mean so much more by bringing people together, and this gives an opportunity for elderly users or people with other reduced mobility to gather together and sit and chat, enjoy the sun, enjoy the views, and get that sense of connectedness. And I think that particularly in light of what we've experienced with COVID last year, that this sort of initiative has shown to be more important than ever, where we can actually do something simple that we know will bring the community closer together. I did have a question about the seating. I do know that our urban designer, Mr. Donnelly, is very conscious of universal access issues, and unfortunately this proposal hasn't been through the Access Committee because we only meet every 2 months. I recognise that it does indicate in here that the seats would be DDA compliant, but I don't see any, there aren't any pictures of the seats that are made available as part of this report. And if there's one thing that I've learnt many things during my time chairing the Access Committee over the last 6 years or so, and that is that DDA compliance is the minimum. And so I would like to think that we're actually going a little bit further than the minimum standard here. And by that I mean, would there be seating which has arms at both ends, but also an armrest in the middle? Because one of the issues for people with limited mobility when they're getting up is that they may need to have armrests on both sides to help raise them up. And unfortunately, some of the seats that I have noticed in our parks and playgrounds don't have armrests on them, or they only have them at both ends. So that can make it difficult for somebody to get themselves out. So I'm interested, I don't know whether Mr. Smee can help with that, or whether it's something that I can just place on record that we could have Mr. Donnelly ensure that we are looking at seats that have that additional armrest in the middle.
Mr. Smee, would you like to make a comment?
Through you, Acting Mayor, I don't know the details of the specific design, but certainly happy to pass on your comments to our urban designer.
Thank you. Look, I raise it because I know that if we have these seats put in and they don't have that additional design feature, then I know there'll be disappointment by many people that perhaps they're not meeting the expectations. And I do think that we should be aiming for sort of gold standards when it comes to DDA matters. So, but apart from that, I think this is a wonderful addition, and I'm sure that other members will support it.
Thank you, Councillor Reid. Councillor Bastone.
Thank you. While I certainly support the proposal for having 12 seats, I query the actual seat chosen, the Classic Plaza DDA approved one, which does not have a middle arm when you look it up on the website. They also don't come from Tasmania, they come from Sydney. Now, here in Tasmania, Sturdy Built, which are in La Trobe, build the Parkmaster seats, which are local government approved and DDA approved, and I'm wondering whether we should not be looking at buying within Tasmania. These seats, which, as I said, do not have the middle arm, are actually $1,900 each, plus, well, it's $1,900 each delivered here to Tasmania. And I'm just wondering, perhaps we can hear how many other seats were looked at and the cost comparison with other seats that were available for the park.
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Acting Mayor, I don't have the details of the procurement process that our urban designer has gone through. Suffice to say that this is his area of expertise, and I would be confident that he's chosen the best product for the appropriate location. But questions as to whether we should be sourcing locally are a broader policy issue for council.
Thank you, Mr. Smee.
I'm just wondering, therefore, can we defer this until we find out the range of seating that actually could be available, considering with the Access Committee wishing to, or Councillor Reid suggesting that we need to have the extra arms, and not knowing what the other ones were that were, the other benches that were considered. I feel we don't have enough information to be spending quite a large amount of money, a total of $31,000 on 12 seats.
Would you like to move to defer, Councillor Bastone?
I would like to move to defer.
Councillor Bastone's moving to defer. Do we have a seconder for that? Seconded by Councillor Wass. The matter before us is that this matter be deferred, that an amount of $31,120 may be made available from the public open space account to fund installation of 12 new park seats within Taroona Park be deferred. Moved by Councillor Bastone, seconded by Councillor Wass. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Those against? The matter is deferred.
Sorry, no, you're not.
But you can submit a comment or a question tomorrow morning after the meeting. Okay, so that item is deferred, which means we move to the final officer's report, which is the financial report for April 2021. On page one, there's a recommendation on page 121. And the recommendation is that Council endorses the attached financial report as at the 30th of April 2021. Do I have a mover for that? Yep. Councillor Cordova, thank you, and seconded by Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. We're looking at the financial report for April 2021. And overall, I would have to say my analysis is that it's pretty good news, but of course I'll welcome the analysis of those eminently more qualified than myself. But basically, rates are $146,000 over budget, with the general rate being $107,000 over, and the garbage rate being $41,000 over budget, of which $11,000 relates to recycling and $26,000 relates to garbage collection. Green waste collection revenue is $4,000 over budget. Statutory fees and fines are $384,000 over budget, due primarily to planning fees, so this speaks again to the rapid growth in the municipality, and user fees are $200,000 over budget, primarily due to the stronger than expected revenue from the Kingborough Sports Centre, which thankfully recovered quicker from the pandemic shutdown than was expected. There was grants recurrent are $419,000 over budget, employee costs are $252,000 under budget, and the rest is there in the report. So I thought I would, I guess one of the things that is worth noting is about the Taz Water dividend, and those are over budget because we essentially anticipated that there would be no dividend, and now there is. They're paying one quarter of dividends due to their performance being better than expected. Essentially, as we went into COVID, there was a great deal of budget uncertainty, and thanks to very good handling and a very prudent approach, Kingborough Council has come off better than expected, and as we start to open up, we can now see that our finances are looking like there are some significant favourable variances. So my first question, I guess, on the financial report is, can you please help explain to us why the grants capital is over budget?
Mr. Breen?
Yeah, through the chair. Essentially, capital grants are very much unknown at the start of the year. We always know that we'll get some road to recovery funding, so we build that into the budget. The rest is all extremely unpredictable and tends to just occur depending on the political environment at a particular point in time. So quite clearly going through a state election means that there'll be significant grants that are up for availability, and we've been very fortunate to get hold of some of those grants, and also the Hobart City Deal funds have certainly been able to boost the numbers in that particular area as well.
Thank you. My next question is about the COVID rates relief and COVID recovery grants that were offered. I can't find the exact spot in this report, but my understanding is that we thought that we would get more call for basically hardship policies than actually we did. Firstly, can you correct me if I'm wrong? And secondly, can you let me know what the plan is for that money in terms of its reallocation going forward?
Mr. Breen.
Yes, through the chair. Yeah, look, essentially at the start of the year, we made a $500,000 allowance, and that was essentially based on the maximum amount that we felt that could be required for support for hardship policies, and it was generally around commercial tenancies and commercial businesses that may be looking for some support. Very little of that's been required. We do have a couple of applications at the moment, but they're not looking as though they are going to meet the requirements of the policy. So, look, at this stage, it's going to be very minor amounts required in terms of the hardship policy. So we have, and I guess on the other side with the hardship policy, we just have supported a lot of residents in regards to deferring their rates and deferring fees and charges in regards to those rates as well. But we're starting to find that people are starting to make those payments and get them back on track again. So it does probably indicate that there has not been significant impact of the pandemic within this particular municipality.
Thank you. And just a follow-up question there through you, Acting Mayor. It's wonderful news that that money is hasn't been spent in the way that we thought it might be spent, and so that leads me to the question of the reallocation of that $500,000 and the strategic ways to spend it, and what is the plan for... Are we able to reallocate that money through the deliberative budgeting process? That what's going to happen to the money?
Mr. Breen.
Yes, through the Chair. Essentially, you'll notice on page 128, the summary report, we are now forecasting a positive variance in regards to our rates revenue of $500,000. So that's money is being allocated back, and I guess what it is doing, it's reducing our underlying deficit that we will experience this financial year. Unfortunately, from an accounting aspect, there's no carry forward of those funds. It just is a reduction in the level of deficit that we will occur this financial year.
Thank you. And so final question, just to be very clear, we're essentially using that money, the reallocation, so to speak, is just to pay down deficit as opposed to potentially reallocating that money for investment in something more exciting.
Mr. Breen.
Yes, through your Chair, that's entirely correct.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Any other contributions on the financial report? No, in that case, Councillor Cordova, would you like to sum up? No? So the recommendation before us, moved by Councillor Cordova and seconded by Councillor Fox, is that Council endorses the attached financial report as at the 30th of April 2021. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against? Motion is carried unanimously. That brings us to page 145, confirmation of items to be dealt with in closed session. Just find that. So the recommendation is that in accordance with the Local Government Meeting Procedures Regulations 2015, Council by absolute majority move into closed session to consider the following items: confirmation of minutes, application for leave of absence, tender assessment, AB 2109, Beach Road footpath widening. In accordance with the Kingborough Council meetings...
So move.
Do I have someone to move that? Thank you, Councillor Fox. Seconded, Councillor Street. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against... Thank you, Council. We'll now move into closed session. The open session of Council is adjourned at 7:05 p.m. In accordance with Kingborough Council meetings, audio recording guidelines policy, recording of the open session of the meeting will now cease. Thank you to those of you at home and in the gallery.